4 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. My guest today is Dalton Caldwell, CEO and co-founder of App.net. Big Web Show is produced in association with HappyCog. At HappyCog, we connect you to your audience through websites and applications that balance beauty, strategy, and utility. Come check out our latest work for the MTV Online Music Awards at HappyCog.com. And HappyCog is sponsoring another South by Southwest Interactive Dribble Meetup. So if you're in Austin this coming Saturday, March 9th, stop by Scholl's Garden and say, hi, y'all. Stop this full of copy that's incorrect. Stop by Scholl's Garden and say, hi, y'all. The fun starts at 8 p.m. at South by Southwest. And now to our guest, Dalton Caldwell. I love that name, by the way.
Dalton, it's a family name.
It's such an American novel name. It's like a coming of age story. And really?
Holden Caulfield.
Yes. Holden Caulfield. Yes. Exactly. So Dalton Caldwell is the CEO and co-founder of App.net, an ad-free social platform and API. App.net aims to be the backbone of the social web through infrastructure that developers can use to build applications and that members can use for meaningful interactions. Dalton, welcome.
Hi, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Really, really glad that you could make time to come on the show. Really appreciate it. And you were born in 1980.
Yes.
Graduated from college in 2003.
That's correct.
And by 2007, as CEO of iMeme, signed landmark agreements with the four major record companies in the world, making iMeme the first company to offer consumers freely streaming, advertiser-supported music. So I would
That's
say
correct.
You pointed the way for Spotify.
Yeah.
And basically the world we're in now. You pointed the way for the world we're in now. And this was out of college. How did that even happen?
So the backstory on iMeme was when I was an undergrad at Stanford, I was really interested in social software. So I did an honors thesis on instant messaging, in fact. And at the time, social software wasn't even called social software. There wasn't really a term for it. And it was something that people look down upon a bit. Like the real smart people were working on search engines and they were working on, you know, routers and servers. And so all this goofy instant messaging, IRC stuff was like way on the fringes. It was not considered a moneymaker. Let's put it that way, right? Remember how blogging used to be portrayed in 2001, 2002. It's very fringe. And I was exposed to these guys at Stanford. One of the guys' name is Orkut Bielkoktun, and he was a grad student, and he started this Stanford-only social network called Encircle, which predated Facebook by 2 years or so.
Wow.
And I knew them, and I was one of the main users in the beta test, and I started helping them out a bit with that. And I was like, wow, this could be big, right? Like, I didn't really have any semblance of how big, but I loved that particular site at the time, and I was like, wow, this – everyone's going to be on something like this. And so and around 2003 was right when Friendster launched and started to take over the Bay Area, which I was in, right? And I was right the demographic. And that's when blogging started taking off. That's right about when Google bought Blogger, which was the hugest right. news. Like, oh, man, that was – I remember that day as being like, wow, you know, blogging's big now and it's a business. And, you know, Six Apart was raising money. And, you know, that was the – that was an interesting time. And, you know,
Neil
at the time,
Dash left New York.
Yes. I remember clearly. And I remember seeing him speak and, you know, he was one of the people I looked up to for sure during that era. And I remember going to a conference then, I guess it was 2003 and on stage was Jonathan Abrams, who was a Friendster guy, Reid Hoffman, who was a LinkedIn guy, Mark Pincus, who was the Tribe guy at the time. There's one other person in the, then there was a moderator and they were talking about the business models of the social web. And I remember Cory Doctorow was in the audience and I met him anyway. So it was a special time And anyone that was there ended up being founders and are people that are now doing things. And I made the decision when I was 23, I was either going to go work at one of those companies. And so that's how I first met Reid Hoffman and John Abrams, is to interview, to just be an entry-level engineer. I was not anybody special. I was just one of the, I just went to the conferences and I thought the stuff was cool and I wanted to be a part of it. And I ended up not opting to work at one of those companies and rather to start my own company. And that was iMeme.
And that takes a lot of guts. And, I mean, admittedly, when you're 20, if you don't have kids and you don't have a mortgage, yeah. I mean, you're not, so there's a little freedom, but it still takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of guts.
Yeah, it was.
How did you know that you could do it?
It just seemed low risk, right? Like I lived in a cheap studio apartment. I was fresh out of school. I was living in downtown Palo Alto, you know, a block away from the original Google office and, you know, where Facebook started, you know, and it just seemed like, why not? And it seemed at that time, everyone was focused on scaling. Friendster was focused on scaling and they had technical problems. And so was LinkedIn. And so it seemed like I would end up just being a low level engineer writing QA tests,
right,
and not writing code. And it seemed like low risk. What was the worst that could happen? Right. That was my mentality at the time.
Right. The worst that could happen, you'd have to move out of that cheap apartment that you didn't really care about.
Right.
Or get a roommate or something.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't, it was the lowest risk. Now I'm older and I have kids and I'm married. So my life is very different now. But at the time I just, whatever, you know, that's what life's all about is,
and by the way, you're older and married and have kids, but you still take risks. You take phenomenal risks.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But I would argue that risk then was bigger, right? Like once you can get to a certain stage in your career, everything's easy, right? The deck is stacked in your favor.
Yes.
Once you have your first success, or once you know people, when you know no one, it's really hard to begin.
Sure. I mean, for me, for HappyCog, we don't take any client for granted, but getting the first client.
Yeah.
Getting the first, and then getting the first reasonable sized company to believe in you and think,
yeah,
these aren't just some clowns. These are, these are professionals who are going to understand what we do and help us do it better. I mean, yeah. So the beginning is really hard and, the odds are still, yeah. So, and you probably know a lot of people. I mean, do you think it helped a lot to be where you were? Do you think?
Yes.
I mean,
it did. Like I can't.
I mean, you know, now the internet's everywhere. I mean, the internet was always everywhere, but now there's a startup scene almost everywhere. But if you'd been in Philly or this, you know, just some,
yeah,
you know, Richmond, Virginia in 2003, it might not have occurred to you. You might have done some other totally cool independent thing because that seems to be your personality, but it might not have been internet related. So how did you come up with the name and how, what's the story there and how did you,
sure.
Yeah.
So the story of iMeme was, so the name had to do with memetics, which was a topic that I was always obsessed with. So memetics is, you know, the study of memes, and memes are the analog to genes, but they're around ideas. So nowadays when we say memes, people think of like cat GIFs and stuff,
right,
which are memes. You know, back in that time, when you said a meme, it was an idea, and powerful ideas self-propagate. And it seemed like something that was happening on the
information
social
information wants to be free is a meme.
Yeah. And some ideas are so powerful that they self-preserve and they multiply. And so
like the Arab Spring or democracy, these are just,
yes,
right.
Or like catchphrases or fads or memes, right? Or like social movements or memes.
Or suddenly every 16-year-old smoking pot in the 60s.
Yeah, that was a very powerful
meme.
Right. And so what we noticed is that the internet was increasing the rate by which memes were spreading. And the social web seemed to be the fertile ground by which, like just looking at what was happening on Friendster and blogs and things like that at the time, it seemed like the lifespan of a meme was changing really quickly.
I just liked
the concept.
Why did you go for music?
So I'll get to that. So,
okay.
So the thesis of iMeme was and I was wrong about this, but the thesis was that a client-server architecture was not the best one for this future social web, right? That I looked at the problems that Friendster and these other guys had scaling, and I was like, oh, well, we should build a fully distributed social network that works like Skype and where you run a desktop client. And once you have the desktop client running, it'll connect to everyone that's in your network. Like the physical topology of the graph will map to your social topology. And then you could do rich media sharing. So at that point, Friendster couldn't even keep their site up. So doing things like music and video and all that was like way, you know, impossible to fathom how they would have done that. And so the idea behind iMeme was to build a fully distributed social network that ran on the client side using a peer-to-peer architecture. And that was the idea. And again, it was like, well, if it doesn't work, okay, we'll learn something. But that was, why did we think it needed to exist and what was the point? It was to write desktop software. Is that so?
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
So that's what we built. And we managed
nicely too. You didn't have the problem of, I don't have any money, but I've got to go get a million servers and yes, gigantic pipes. I've got to hook right up to the internet because I have to be ready for anything. You could be, basically, yes, our users will be our network.
Precisely.
My user's and hardware is the hardware.
Precisely. And at the time, I mean, think about what a piece of crap Apache was then. There was no Lighty. There was no Nginx. Like, there was... Technology has changed. Remember the RAM limit, the 4 gigabyte RAM limit in servers? The 64-bit servers changed everything. At that time, I mean, again, like just watching what was going on at Friendster and watching what was going on everywhere, that there was actually technical limitations that made large-scale social networking basically impossible.
Right.
So that was the thinking.
Right. It's not that we're better designers or coders today. It's that basically Moore's Law has enabled us to, yeah.
I believe that. Yeah. Long polling, Nginx. I mean, AWS. Amazing things have happened on what you can build out of the box. It's just running this thing now. I mean, I could see the difference. So that was the original idea. And so we built desktop software. And to be honest, it really didn't go anywhere. And the reason was people had already been burned by malware, and they don't want to install desktop software. They don't like the idea that they're running their own server. It scares them. Cross-platform was tough.
They also don't want Time Warner Cable saying, we think you have a copyright violation. You downloaded, yes, a file you shouldn't have downloaded, or someone, you didn't even look at it yourself, but someone transferred a file on your computer that they shouldn't have.
Precisely. Firewalls, right? This is IPv6 may solve some of this, but doing NAT traversal was very difficult, and we spent a bunch of time on that. And at the end of the day, we built a product that was very clunky from an onboarding perspective, and just it wasn't the best thing. And ironically, I don't know if you've heard this story, but Zuckerberg moved to Palo Alto during that era to work on something called WireHog. And WireHog, you can Google this, WireHog was it was a lot like this. it was a desktop software that mapped to your Facebook social graph and did all these various things. So very similar idea. And actually it was Sean Parker who talked him out of it, that said that was a waste of time and they should just focus on building web applications because no one wants to install WireHog. So this idea keeps popping up. I see people that were just like me trying to run that play over and over again.
Even just having to install Java or AIR is kind of a problem today.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, look, man, we had a team and we built some great software. And what's funny is our designer, he was a really young guy. He is now the co-founder of Path. His name is Dustin Moreau. And he's one of the most famous designers on the web, right? So, yeah, he was like 19 and was designing icons for me back in the day. Like, so we had a great talent on us, yeah, right? Dustin was there and it was a beautiful client, but we never got traction. And we watched things that were way easier to use out of the box and way more intuitive get tremendous traction. And honestly, the wake up call for me was we saw YouTube launch. And what's funny is because where we were physically, we hear about things launching like the day they launch. So I heard about YouTube launch 1 or 2 days after they put it up. And I remember the first time I saw YouTube.com, there was a pager at the bottom of the pages and you could see every video on YouTube. How funny is that? Right. Wow. Like I remember being like, I remember paging through the front page of YouTube and then hitting the last page. And what's funny is we mocked it. We were like, oh man, this is never going to scale. They're never going to be able to keep their servers up. They're never going to be able to deal with the copyright issues. What a joke. What are these guys thinking? We thought it was hilarious. But the fact is, when you got a YouTube link and you clicked on it, it used Flash Video, it downloaded fast, and it just worked. Mm-hmm. Remember?
Yeah.
What it was like, it was not that much better technically, the user experience was amazing.
Do you think they always had in the back of their mind selling to Google as an end game?
Because in the early days, no.
Because that's the logical solution to the problem they had.
In the early days, I don't think they did. But once it took off, I'm sure you've heard these stories, but it's pretty well known that they were literally days away from getting sued by the entire music industry. There was a pending lawsuit, and that during the 11th hour negotiation with Google, they signed a deal with the labels because they told the labels, if you don't sign this deal, we can't sell to Google. And if we sell to Google, you're going to get a ton of money from us. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like they did this crazy 11th hour negotiation to prevent the hammer getting struck on them.
It was the mafia. It's all like,
yeah.
Okay. But you, in all the story you've told so far about, we haven't even gotten to app.net yet, which is cool. We have plenty of time, but in iMeme, we still haven't gotten to music.
So here's where I'm going. So one of my board members at the time, one of my friends was the employee number one of the original Napster, and he built all the peer-to-peer stuff, and it was hugely influential on me. And he was the COO of Fanning's company at the time, which was called Snowcap. And Snowcap built a content registry for copyrighted music. And the idea was in a Supreme Court ruling vis-a-vis Napster, they wanted the judge said that if there was a registry that existed of all owned content and that Napster could filter them out via fingerprints, then you could justify having a service like that living on forever. It was like a judicial standard. And so Snowcap spent 5 years and all this money building a content database where they had fingerprints from all the labels. It was registered and they could look at an MP3 and do a run a fingerprint on it and be able to tell what it was. And so the thinking I mean was, you know what, YouTube might get shut down, but what a great user experience. Let's take all this code that we have. Let's take this team that we have and abandon the client server, abandon peer-to-peer, right? Because it's a pain in the butt. And let's build YouTube for music. And what we're going to do is use this content registry from Snowcap so that when a user uploads a file, we fingerprint it on our side. It doesn't require desktop software. We could see who the content owner is and actually do a revenue share back to the label, right? We saw it as a sane cure to piracy, where now they can actually track and see what's being played, and now they're actually going to be compensated for the streams that are happening, and it would provide a continual revenue stream as opposed to piracy where you get paid once.
In the same way that, you know, when we do our conference, we have music and we pay BMI and ASCAP. Uh-huh. Because and it's kind of the same thing. They didn't say, hey, you can't play our records. The recording industry couldn't say, you can't play our music in a public place. That would be silly. So they said, okay, how can we compensate ourselves and maybe the artists a little bit too, but mostly ourselves? How can we compensate ourselves and allow this use? And how can we allow this use and not lose control? Because it's really about that and ownership. If you allow a use, then you're opening the door to someone saying, well, you don't really own this, or you can, yeah. Yep. How did you approach the four major record companies?
So we knew people through the Napster people, obviously, for better and worse. And so I had advice from someone that, you know, Ollie was there the whole time during the litigation. So I had people that were very familiar and comfortable with all this stuff. And honestly, we hired an attorney who does nothing but music deals, and he did the Spotify deals and everything else. What's funny is it's Clive Davis's son. So we got Clive Davis's son on as our attorney.
That makes sense.
And that's what he would do, is he'd bring in people like me to the labels and explain, like, he did the YouTube deals. He did, this was his thing. Like, he was the guy that did this, and that we began discussions. And so my naivete at the time thought, because Snowcap was licensed and because we had a straightforward business model and because we truly wanted to pay them, we weren't just trying to have some loophole, right? This wasn't Mega Upload, that there would be a straightforward route to doing deals and getting it licensed. And what happened is our traffic took off unlike anything I've ever seen. And we went from no traffic to, we were signing up 60,000-70,000 people a day. We got, you know, 20 million registered users in, I don't know, 12 months. I mean, it was one of the largest growth stories in that Web 2.0 era.
And what were you, what were they what were they paying?
Who? The labels?
The consumers.
Oh, the consumers were paying zero. It was ad supported, right? So this gets to the app.net stuff, as I learned a lot about the ad business. So at that time, we were running just ad networks. And I had the same hand wavy ideas that a lot of founders say to this day, that you see, like, oh, we just want to focus on growth. And, you know, we're going to build a content targeted system. And I had this whole theory that you could use music taste to target ads to people. And, oh, I had
but that
a whole,
would be down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's all down the road. We're just going to focus on growth. And so in the meantime, we're going to have these crappy ad networks. But someday there's going to be a magical ad system that's going to just be so amazing, and everyone's going to love it, right? So I read from the same script that you read, that you see everyone say all the, you know, to this day, I read this stuff every day in the tech press. So I was reading the same script.
You read the tech press every day? Does it depress you to read the tech press every day?
Sometimes.
Do you have to?
I have to, and I'm interested in it. And I don't think that those guys are lying. I don't think David Karp's lying. I just think David Karp's going to have a tough time, man. Like, good luck, dude. Maybe he'll figure it out. So I don't think depressing is the term. I keep track on what the latest and greatest is.
And you, when you sold to MySpace,
so what happened with the music industry is that the music industry was really excited that we grew. And what I thought is that they wanted to make money from licensing the service on a forward basis, and that that'd be very attractive to them. But what I didn't realize is that the digital music business model now is to license people and get huge chunks of upfront money and then hope they go out of business. Right? Like, so here's the way this works. And maybe this is a little bit too inside baseball for you. When Spotify does a deal with the music industry, they pay them $30 or $40 million upfront, right? And then that recoups on a forward basis against actual usage. And when it's time for a new deal, they pay the whole thing upfront again.
Wow.
So there's a business strategy for the labels where they're actually incentivized to take that upfront money and then hope you go out of business so that you never actually recoup. They don't want you to recoup, right? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yes. No.
So we ended up in a situation where we needed to raise ridiculous amounts of money, which we did. I raised over $70 million for that company.
How?
And how? I did a lot of fundraising. That's a whole different story. Okay. Yeah.
We're going to have you back on and talk about that.
Raising,
but,
yeah.
But let's keep talking about...
I'm not like, oh, way to go, I raised so much money.
To hear about it. I'm sure other people would too. But let's just keep the focus on creativity, engineering,
we managed to raise that money and we paid them the upfront stuff. And lo and behold, they didn't care. And the rates were abnormally high. And you would think they would want to not... You'd think that they would care if we ended up in tough financial times, but they didn't. And so we ended up in financial duress right around the 2008 crash, where we needed more money and we couldn't get it. And so I ended up fire selling it to MySpace. That was the best I could do. Mm-hmm. Right. And that was, and at the end of the day,
and they destroyed it.
Yeah. I mean, but I could just easily say it's my fault for even doing those deals and playing in the music business. Right. Like, I don't know anyone that's ever done a music startup that hasn't had a similar thing happen. And I had smart people warning me about the dangers. So So I would argue that Spotify will likely face the same outcome, not because it's a fantastic product and not because it's not licensed, but it's if 100% of your business is based upon licensing someone else's content and they could change the rates at any time arbitrarily, your profit will be zero or negative, right? Because they can see how much profit you're making and could just raise the rates at a moment's notice. And if they withhold, if UMG decided not to license Spotify, Spotify is out of business. Like if you as a subscriber, if a third of the music was gone, there's only three labels now, right? One of the labels withholding their content means you don't have a business. That's barely a business, is it? Right?
Wow. So of course, basing your business on someone else's API can also be.
Precisely.
So let's get to it. Your latest hugely ambitious project is app.net. It's an alternative to Twitter, currently mainly used by tech folks.
Yes.
Its points of difference are, and correct me if any of this is right, it's ad-free. It's, yes. It supports third-party developers in ways Twitter no longer does, or, right? Twitter's basically said, we can change this at any time, and we're definitely restricting, and you're saying, no, if we put something out there, you can keep using it, and right?
Yep.
And then, and it allows you to post messages with twice as many characters as Twitter allows.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it is that app.net is a social API for other people to build applications on top of. And so I tend not to focus on the properties of any one piece of software. I think of it as if you took the Facebook API and you took the Twitter API and you lopped off all the stuff built on top of the API and just... If Facebook spun off Facebook API as its own company, right, and they licensed it, that is what app.net is meant to look like, right? Like where this came from, just some backstory is that over the summer I went to Foo Camp. I don't know if you've ever been to.
I haven't been, but I know. So for people who don't know, it's still O'Reilly, right?
Yeah, it's Tim O'Reilly's Friends of O'Reilly conference, and he invites all sorts of really interesting people.
It's like
and,
a geek TED.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the big theme of all the little panels that I attended that year and that I was into was talking about the fact that everything good that was in the open web turned to crap. And is it inevitable? And I think it's okay for me to say that, like, Anil Dash was in those meetings. Like he was talking a lot and I was listening a lot. And so there was people like Anil in there, and I won't name drop other people, but people that were part of the foundational open web from the beginning in the, you know, sitting in rooms and everyone's just like scratching their heads being like, yeah, you know, what happened to Twitter, man? Like, this is terrible. And I get, and just kind of,
ambivalent. For listeners who don't know,
sure.
What would you say? Can you give an unbiased, just a definition of a description of what happened? How did Twitter change?
Well, here's my thesis, and I've blogged about this quite a bit. The metaphor that social web has taken has been to become a media company and to adopt media company business models. Media company business models have been with us a long time. And the way it works is you have content, and it is your content. And using this content, you can show advertising against it, or you can sell it on an a la carte basis.
Facebook, say, showing my friend's wife a picture of my friend's wife and putting it next to an ad for a dating service.
Precisely, right? And everyone has taken for granted that the only sane business model for large-scale social networking is the media business, right? It's eventually creating targeted advertising and being able to display it at scale. And the issue is the financial motivations of a media business suggest that you want to control content. And so there's a few outcomes of that. Someone showing your, quote-unquote, your content in a third-party UI – and either putting their own ads in or just hiding your ads is bad.
Right.
That's bad. That's bad. That's without any opinion. That is not a good That is not good to have happen to your business.
Right. That's readability. Got in trouble for just
precisely.
Right, okay.
Right. Okay. Like you don't want to get aggregate. You don't want the Huffington Post to copy and paste everything and show it and put ads on it, and then you don't get any traffic. Right. That is the
model for a lot of the big content blogs, the big successful content blogs. They have a chimp scan someone else's content, type it, you know, and stick a picture of a woman in a bikini at the bottom.
Yes. And that's the media business. Like that's the race to zero of the media business is you end up with a situation where you want to hold on to all your content, and you need to, because that's your business. So you're not a bad guy for wanting to hold on to the content. That's the business you're in. You also need to track performance. So things like T.co, things like controlling, all these things are bits and pieces. So you could show to an advertiser, hey, this click led to this sale. Right. And I went through this running iMeme. I had a huge sales team and we sold a lot of advertising. It's really important to be able to track performance through the entire funnel. And so you're going to end up sticking your hooks into all these different pieces because that's your business. Right. Additionally, things like Twitter cards are really important because then you could show targeted advertising on an embedded site and track impressions and click-throughs.
Right.
Right. Otherwise, if you're copying and pasting the text out, that's bleeding traffic out of your media business, right?
Right.
That's really bad. And so I'm not passing judgment on any of those decisions.
Well, it's not how they started. It's like you were saying a moment ago, everybody starts very idealistically and says, we'll figure out the money later and let's just build a great community.
Correct.
And then eventually a grown-up comes into the room and says, so you need advertising.
Yes. And to actually do real advertising, not, hey, we're going to do advertising someday. But if you really hire sales teams, and I had a huge sales team and we were doing $2 million a month gross in advertising. So man, I used to fly to Coke. I used to fly to Pepsi. I used to be in those big pitch meetings, like, you know, Dazzling, Shazam, you know, I've been there and I think I get what those guys want. And so that's why it's funny. The Facebook news today about the newsfeed redesign, that's all about monetizability. They want big images. They want big videos. Like this is all about changing the product to serve what is most monetizable via advertising, right? Mm-hmm. That is what's been defining these roadmaps. And again, that's not evil. That's okay. Right. But
it's never about the user experience.
No. And it's not about there's no room for third party developers except in that one quadrant, I guess, where they're helping doing ad targeting stuff. Like that stuff, I guess they said was okay. You know, like the data mining companies, I guess are fine. But other than that, all those other quadrants, yeah. Those are not good for your business. Those are like, that doesn't help you make more money. That dilutes your user experience. That dilutes your pitch to advertisers. So I get it. I get why you wouldn't, you know, I see why a logical, sane, smart, good person that works at these companies would make the decisions they're making vis-a-vis the developer community.
Well, you have to say that.
No, but I mean it. I really do.
Okay.
I genuinely don't like, that was the thing with the music.
Do you
business.
Think that you can, so bad guy. So your model, as opposed to that, is you set a $50 price point. It's $50 per year to use it. Actually, you have free now, right?
Yeah, we went freemium. And so
in February?
Yes, that just happened recently.
Right.
So going back to the thought experiment. So we're here and we're thinking about, well, how do you prevent, is this an inevitable cycle that every single company is always going to one day hire a grown-up and the founders leave and the thing turns evil? Like, is that required? And so I spent a lot of time racking my brain around that. Simultaneously, I'd been building a bunch of stuff on the Facebook platform for my company closely with their support. And as I blogged about, they ended up pulling the rug out from under me and cloning precisely what we were working on, which I did not appreciate at all. So all these ideas are in my head and I'm just, you know, the gears are spinning. And I started thinking about hosting models, and I started thinking about Dropbox and GitHub and Amazon Web Services. And the thought experiment is this. Service-based companies are not, they don't monetize controlling content. They monetize running the plumbing, right?
Yes.
So if you pay for an internet connection or you pay your cell phone provider for a connection, you're getting services, they're providing pipes, and bits are throwing through the pipes. But the company doesn't really give a crap what those bits are. And if anything, they want you to flow more bits through the pipes, right? And
well, they do try to have it both ways. Again, all the big cable companies. That's true.
They diversified. You're right.
But that's a side point.
And so when I thought about a company that doesn't inevitably turn evil, I thought about Dropbox. I personally put a ton of trust into that company. All of my private files are in there, right? And imagine if one day they said, oh, bad news. We're going to take your file listing and we're going to sell it to advertisers. And like, we're going to, you know, do some data sharing. Like, just try to picture that. You'd be like, whoa, what? That wouldn't happen, I would argue, right? Like, even if an evil guy went and took that company over, maybe the product would get less good, but they couldn't just flip around and hold back your content because you're paying for hosting services.
Right.
So the thought experiment that is app.net is my belief. So here's my big vision. Imagine that you had a personal cloud of your social data, okay? And you owned it and you controlled it and you trusted it. And you could try out any cool new social app that came out. So imagine back from the time of Friendster, all of your photos from Friendster stayed in your personal cloud. And, oh, we're going to move to MySpace. And, oh, I'm going to try out this new blogging platform.
App.net doesn't offer that. Everything I do on the web is sort of aggregated and saved there.
We have a file API, yes. So that's why we shipped a file API. So the idea is, say there's a photo app that comes out and it's built, it uses the app.net API. When you log into it, you can have your social graph, which is obviously in our API, and it's your social graph, not ours. So we're like, cool, you know, go nuts, you know, import it in your friends list, have fun. And also you could choose to import in your photos out of your personal cloud. And instead of leaving those photos in the silo of that specific app, they stay in your personal cloud. And so the switching cost, we're intentionally trying to make the switching cost go to zero. And why are we doing this? It's not because we're good guys and, you know, trust us. It's we make more money the more apps that are built on top of us. We make more money the more storage that you choose to consume on the platform and keep it there. And so we end up with an inverted financial incentive so that we're like, please build on us. Please build
like
on
Dropbox.
Us.
Like Dropbox. Yes. Right.
We make tons of money. Like the more people that build on us and use our pipes, the more money we make.
Now, does the investment community that you live in understand what you're doing and like what you're doing? Because I know that there are some. So, go ahead.
It's complicated because there are people that are on different teams. And so there's certain people with vested interests that really, 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 really don't like what we're doing and have gone out of their way to sneer at us and say terrible things a lot. But on the other hand, my board member through this entire process and my personal mentor has been Mark Andreessen. He showed up at our hackathon 3 days ago. He's been watching. He cares a lot. And he's a visionary, right? Like, he's a bold guy. I know some people don't like certain aspects of his personality, but, you know, like, we can thank him for the IMG tag, right? Like,
right. No, he, for any, for listeners who are under 32, he invented Mosaic browser and then he invented the Netscape browser. And even though it's not around today, or although it may still be, did they finally kill it? I don't know. But the whole world that we inhabit is because of those things.
Right? Yes. And I've talked to him a lot about this. Tim Berners-Lee and those guys didn't want a graphical web browser because they thought it would turn the web from an academic pursuit into porn, like a porn kind of thing. Mm. Like, if you put images in the web, they're like, oh, no, don't do it. Don't do it. And so he actually had to disobey everyone and ignore all their best advice when he created the IMG tag.
This created there's legacy problems to those. I admire him as a visionary, but there's all the decisions that he made have had. I mean, we're still working through stuff.
Agreed.
Yeah, right.
Right. So he's been really supportive. And I mean that genuinely. He's always been like, don't be afraid, Dalton, just do what you're going to do.
You've got like Tim O'Reilly is big on your network and John Gruber, I think. And I think you have a lot of tech people who really get what you're doing. Yeah. How do you reach out beyond that market, or do you?
Well, so what's hard about social networks is that you have to bootstrap them. And bootstrapping problems are the most interesting problems. Like if you think about, you know, how did life originate? You know, did it spontaneously happen? Or, you know, like bootstrapping problems, you can see how something works once it gets to scale, but getting that first bump off the ground is very difficult.
Right.
So our approach to bootstrapping this is we think it's A-okay that this appeals to people that are designers and programmers and iOS developers because they get it. And I don't expect normal people to get this, right?
So,
they don't
so
need to get
right them. Now you're like South by Southwest was 10 years ago.
I suppose so. And the idea is these are the people that are building it. We're bootstrapping. So a very large percentage, because a large percentage of the user base is people that build apps, these guys are sensitive to the issues. And a lot of them have built Twitter clients in the past or Facebook clients in the past. And they, you know, built all these different things. And so they're like, wow, this is awesome. I'm going to start building my stuff here. And it's been fascinating to see these people move over and poke around with the APIs, because my belief on how this thing grows is that what's going to attract people is the software that is built. And
right.
My core thesis, and this is what this project will be judged on more than anything, but my core thesis is that better software will be built on top of a non-ad supported platform than could be built elsewhere. Like, I don't think in the future someone should use an app.net enabled app because it's good for them and they should care about user privacy and they should care about platforms. Like, I get normal people don't give a crap about that stuff.
Right.
But if the better developers are here and they're truly innovating, like think about how much innovation came out of the Twitter ecosystem and how much innovation came out of the iOS ecosystem. If this is where all the action's happening on people building the next latest and greatest things, holy cow, this is going to win.
Right, right. Well, you look back at, when the iPhone came out and the skepticism.
It was tiny, right?
And the skepticism was, I mean, in hindsight, well, Steve was a genius and he was right. But in another way, no, the developers and designers who figured out what to do with it, that, and Twitter, certainly, what people used to say about Twitter, well, I don't see the point of it. In like 2007, there wasn't much point to it until, you know, Twitterific and Tweetbot. And, yeah, right.
Like, it was made by third-party developers.
Right.
Right,
Which is why what happened subsequently is so unfortunate. It's like having a certain audience that you build your career with and then turning your back on that audience and punishing them once you achieve a certain level of success, which happens a lot in business and entertainment. But
yes, it does.
It's painful. And it's you're painful. Not going to do that. So how do people know to trust you in that you're not going to do that? Because it's open. What? Go ahead.
It's an excellent question. The core way that we've done this is to set up the right financial incentives. Meaning we get paid, like think about this, we get paid more money the more people develop for the platform. And hosing developers is wildly inconsistent with that particular business model.
Right.
Additionally, we've intentionally not built first-party apps. So out of the gate, the plan was to not launch with any first-party apps at all.
Yeah, that was really gutsy, I have to say.
So people...
That was like launching with an idea.
Right. So people thought we were full of crap. And so a lot of the powerful people in tech were like, oh yeah, this guy is full of shit. Like Syracuse, like they all called it vaporware. And so we took this API and we built a web application, which is alpha, in 2 weeks. And we gave that web application to people to show that we are not, you know, scammers.
Right.
And that we could build software and that this API was real. And that the fact is we internally could build a really compelling user experience in 2 weeks on top of this API. And here's the API. And frankly, it worked. And so it does mean that we still have alpha around. And I think I'm okay with that. We also built the group messaging app Omega, and we BSD licensed Omega. So the way we're going to think about this on a forward basis is that if we build internal code that exercises the API, we're going to BSD license it. Because again, you know, think about iOS development. when you give away lots of excellent source code to people and lots of great examples and you let them bootstrap off your project, it actually helps developers. It doesn't compete with them. So basically what I'm saying is if we don't have first party apps, what?
Right. And right. And again, not to dump on Twitter. I love Twitter and you can't belittle their achievement, but they really want you to use their app, not other people's apps, which may be better. And it's like the blogging problem we discussed earlier, where if you're putting my content on your site with your ads and hiding my ads, you're hurting me. You don't have any of those problems. Just by the nature of your business, you don't have any of those problems. So you want people to do whatever they can, take the content, make remix.
Yes, because that adds value for why you'd want to pay for an account, right? Or why you'd want to maintain your account or get premium features or get more storage, right? It's all about, and so that way, if a new app comes out, fantastic, a new app came out, hooray, like this adds value.
Now we're running short of time for this interview, but I, and not to put you on the spot, but is there anything coming out soon from a third party that you know about that we should know about or any area that we could?
So did you see the thing Steve Strezza built?
No, what is that? What's the URL? So,
I'll send it. It's Project Amy. So go to directory.app.net and then you'll see Project Amy at the top.
Directory.app.net, NetBot for iPad, Amy right at the top.
Yes.
Okay.
So Steve Strezza.
Is it Siri based on app.net?
No, it's messages. So the default OS X messages client, he built a plugin to connect to our group messaging infrastructure. So once you set that up, you can go in and have all your private messages show up in messages.app. And you could also join group chats. We built in all the API things to do basically like AOL chat rooms.
Right.
And those exist. And so now every single person with a Mac has a really good polished UI to access all of our messaging infrastructure. So he built this hack, you know, in a couple of weeks, but how awesome is that?
Wow.
Right. So that just came out and people are really excited about it. Cause again, it shows that doesn't look like microblogging. That doesn't look like Twitter. This is
something new.
This is some weird stuff, but this is awesome. Right. And we're totally happy about it because we don't care that you're using a different UI. We're not monetizing the fact that you're using a UI that's not ours. We're like, cool, use messages.app, knock yourself out. This adds value. This helps our business model.
Why do you think there's more Mac stuff than Windows or Linux?
I think it's because who the developers are that have been building on it. Because remember, this wasn't a planned community. Every single app you see in that directory was built by someone. And the people that have been big supporters that have been building, a lot of them tend to be Mac and iOS people. And there has been, there's been action happening on Android. And the fact that we even have a Windows Phone 7 client is hilarious, which shows, you know, like someone built that and it's good. So it's almost like a proxy of where developer attention is.
Right. Right. That makes perfect sense too. Right. Because most people are still focused on iOS and Windows. I'm sorry. Yes. iOS and Android. That's where people are.
And the other thing I would add is the way to think about this, app.net apps do not have to exercise the entire API and they do not need to look like microblogging. You could use it for just login and importing your social graph. You could use it for that plus file workflow. Someone's working on something that runs in your system tray on the Mac and lets you drag files in and drag files out using our file API.
Wow.
That's all A-okay. And so it's important to expand your mind to think of, it's not like there's going to be 50 guys all trying to build the best Tweetbot clone, right? No, that market's, you know, well-saturated. Tweetbot, right. You know, those guys are on it. But these sorts of applications you could build, and if you could take for granted that every time a user authenticates, they have storage attached to their account, that it works cross-platform, they can take for account that they can do messages, private messages, group messages. The idea is to enable new stuff we haven't seen before, and that's going to be the source of innovation that makes this compelling and sticky in the future to normal people. Because they'll be like, wow, what an awesome app. I want to use this. this is amazing, right? That's what attracts normal people, is that kind of stuff.
Yes. Right, exactly. People didn't get excited about the iPhone. Normal people didn't get excited about the iPhone because of the contours of it, or because it had wow, they've replaced hover with touch events. No, nobody cared.
But that's correct.
There's a million apps, or there's this app that makes me look old. There's this app that makes me look fat. There's this old app that makes, that makes my kid look like a grown up. That's fun. Like, that's what people, right.
Fart apps.
Yeah. Right. Porn built the web, and fart apps built iPhone and Android.
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, Dalton, this has been great. I really thank you for your time today, and I hope we can have you on the show again in a few months or next year to see where you are and what you built. Please stay in touch. And if besides app.net, people should look for you on where?
Just there.
Okay.
You can private message me. There's different ways to reach out and touch me. Oh, my blog is just daltoncaldwell.com.
Right, daltoncaldwell.com.
And what I'm really looking forward to is having the conversation about app.net be about the applications built on top of it.
Yes.
Top of it, and not us as infrastructure. Like, I'm so excited that that's what's happening now, is all the focus is going on what people are doing with it and not on the platform, because the platform is not meant to be interesting.
It's a university that's judged by the students.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.